go around the table with everyone saying their name and connection. Okay, so.
Moshe Tarrigan, Talmud of the Yeshiva.
Danny Looney, I was in high school in 2011, 2013.
Is Hill okay? Is Hill also there?
No, I'm
is it? He's not there.
Darren, let's see, I have no connection other than it's, I attended one of the, I guess, the annual event where they honored my friend in Portage, and they keep sending me emails. So
it's working.
Thank you.
So I'm 5 inches as from 2 years in the yeshiva in the late 80s, and I think about next year my son.
I would really thank you, Stephanie, for sending me.
Gene Schaefer, I personally have so
much. Nice to meet you.
It was a long time.
Wait, I'm sorry, what's your name?
Yeah, Ken.
Which year were you there?
Well, now you've been making that. I think it was 77, 78 or 78.
Oh, okay, so we missed it.
77.
Okay, what? Yaakov.
Yes.
Yes,
it
is.
Phil Burkhardt, I was at Yeshiva in 2000 and 2001. Ellie Isaac, 2000 and 2001. Josh Lassie, 2001 and 2007.
Roger Higgins, 2 years ago this year.
Eisenberg, I listened to your
stream
online.
Daniel Weinstein, I was in Yeshiva 2004. My wife was at New Delos, and we both attended Bruce.
And of course,
Dr. David, Shirley Schuster.
And
Debbie
Granavich,
the new
director
of alumni relations.
Okay,
good afternoon, everyone. What a great source to be together. More or less now, the buses are rolling away from the Kever. They're returning back after an entire day of shiurim and discussions. And I think it's a testament, obviously, to Rav Lichtenstein that you're all here, to his memory, and not just to the Torah that he has spread, but also to, also to the fact that I think as people who are affiliated with the yeshiva, we feel that there's a resonance and a durability to the Torah we learned that reverberates beyond the age of 19 and 20. And we're able to return to the yeshiva and draw from its Torah and its wellspring of ideas when we're, most of you are under 40, when we're 39 years old, even when we're 39 years old. So I think it's a real testament, and we're far away from the center, ground zero, of where people are commemorating Rav Lichtenstein's life and his accomplishments, but obviously it's when you're with the right people, then makom and placement is irrelevant. So we feel as if the yeshiva and its spirit and Rav Lichtenstein and his brilliance and his Torah are very much present in this room. I think what was so striking about Rav Lichtenstein to many of us, well, first let me take a step back. For people that didn't meet him and just knew him or learn of him through his Torah, his reputation, erudite, scholarly, PhD in Milton, the practitioner of the Brisker Derech, and it's very highfalutin, intellectually impressive accomplishments, they expect to meet a person who is an intellectual and cerebral and whose compulsion or compelling ideas and scintillating intellect would change people's lives. And to those who really knew him, and most of the people around this table in one way or another really got to know him, it was less about his brilliance and just more about who he was as a person and his character traits and the way that he worked feverishly to try to improve himself as a human being. I must confess, I think about him probably close to 10 or 15 times a day, and I feel his shadow. Rarely do I think of the Torah he taught me. More often than not, when I try to be a better, and you fill in the blank, I think of him. A better husband, a better father, a better human being, a better neighbor, a better, I think of his image, and I feel his hand almost moving my hand or moving my heart. This is what he would do. This is how he would behave, and I should try to aspire towards similar goals. And the way in which he worked to improve himself as a human being, and not just in the classic areas of human experience that are typically associated with Frumkeit, that are written about in the Musar Sfarim, learning and devotion and prayer and piety, and you can almost open any Sefer Musar and find discussions and of course, not just Sifrei Moser, but Chazal and Tanakh. But in areas just of human caliber and human identity and work ethic and just simple kindness and gentlemanliness and speaking softly, and we felt as if we saw a human being working and striving towards the perfection of the human condition. And for some other time, we'll talk about Rav Lichtenstein's ceaseless attempt to fuse humanism and religion, which is not an easy union. Many people would view humanism and religion, and certainly in the modern era, as dichotomous, or as opposing goals, and certainly secular humanism looks to displace, to supplant religious identity. But obviously, Rav Lichtenstein was a religious humanist, and part of that was the sense that I could be a better Oved Hashem by being a better human being. There's not one facet of my human identity that shouldn't be addressed, and by addressing and improving those aspects, I can become a better Oved Hashem. And I think that's what struck so many of us, that the sichot that we heard weren't just targeting the five or six classic, and I'm in no way saying it chas v'chalila in derision of others, but we tend to hear a very narrow field of areas that the Musar world addresses. Midos, davening, hasmada. You felt as if, what are the aspects that human beings, what identities do they contain? How could they be improved? And this improvement would lead to a more profound sense of Avodas Hashem. And the fact that he culled ideas from Chazal, from Tanakh, it gave it an organic feel. As if we weren't taking a break from our learning to discuss improving our humanity, but our feet were firmly anchored in a sugya and a medrash and a pasuk. And somehow he reminded us that Chazal's vision and view was global and panoramic, and it addressed the total sweep of human experience. And even in areas in which he didn't feel Chazal addressed it that broadly, because quite frankly they had more important things to involve, they were discussing important legal issues. And so when he would quote sources to help sharpen and amplify the aspects of human character that he was trying to deliver and convince us of their importance. So I chose one such area, which I think resonates very deeply with those who knew him, the importance of a work ethic. We all saw how hard he worked. And these are all sources that he spoke about and shirim that he delivered, and many of them are printed on the VBM or in other publications of Yeshiva. Just really culled and gathered ideas and sources and tried to organize them in a somewhat coherent fashion. Rav Lichtenstein spoke often about the pasuk, source number one, Vayikach Hashem Elokim es Adam Vayanichehu Began Eden Leovda Uleshamra. Very, very beloved pasuk to Rav Lichtenstein. Leovda Uleshamra. I can hear his voice in the guttural incantation. We're not just workers, we're custodians. Remember that? Whenever he wanted to emphasize a point, his voice lowered a few calibers, and I feel like he was speaking from his gut, not from his voice. It was like a different mechanics of speaking. When he became morally righteous and morally compelling, you felt a more, it was an amazing experience, not just to hear the content, but to feel the style and the delivery, and to see how every fiber of his being was invested in that moral idea. I was speaking to some high school kids, and I said to them, "You're looking at me, but I promise you that if you came to my home, you wouldn't see the same me. You'd see me possibly in jeans, discussing things with my kids around the table." So you never meet the same person. When the offset between the public face and the personal experience is too broad, that's called hypocrisy. I assume that if you met me at home, I would hope you'd see more or less the same person in a different context and a different framework. When the little thing spoke to us, we felt like he was speaking down to us. Not condescending, as if he were demanding us and calling us to higher ground, but in no way demanding of us the same levels that he achieved. He was demanding that we sleep a little less and work a little harder. We knew that he'd be sleeping 4 hours a night, and he expected us to get by with only six or to work a little harder. We never thought that he was pontificating or preaching. It felt as if he was living an idea, and the moral compulsion was so overwhelming you couldn't escape it. As if this, imagine a spotlight shining, a moral spotlight shining so brightly, it was just inescapable. You felt almost cornered. You didn't have a choice but to be drawn towards improvement, because his message wasn't just so reverberant, but it was so personally experienced. And Rav Lichtenstein noted the fact that man's first command, his first instruction from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is to be a producer and a worker, a toiler, an investor, a preserver and a protector, Leovda Uleshomra. And keep in mind that this instruction is delivered prior to the fall of man, We typically associate work and toil, b'zeh sapecha tochel lechem, b'tzvan ruach, kotz v'dardar tetzmiach lach, the work and toil that we all feel drawn by and in some ways tormented by, is a product of the fall of man and the double curse in the wake of the expulsion and the wake of the murder. And this pasuk reminds us that ideally man is born to work. It's part of man's essential identity to work and to produce. What type of work was even necessary in Gan Eden, which presumably the entire world harmoniously colluded or collaborated with man's agenda, in which thorns were not meant to be removed and the ground didn't produce obstacles, but rather fertile yields and ready produce? So even in the absence of a curse and a condemnation, even the absence of need and function, man's identity is determined as a worker and a producer and a guardian and a steward of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's vast world. And that same idea, which Rav Lichtenstein drew, I'm going to speak tonight in Teaneck as I'm giving a share for Rav Lichtenstein's yard site. Remember how he used to take two words, or sometimes two letters within the same word, and spend an hour and a half splitting those two? And I remember the shiur in which he literally took the words Li'ovdo, L'shamra, and spoke for an hour and a half about the differences. And the Friday night sichot in yeshiva and in his prime were an hour and a half, minimum. Minimum. My wife, she's such a tzaddikas, we used to make kiddush in the summer sometimes at 10:45 at night. And I'd walk in the room and my wife would say, what did Rav Lichtenstein speak about tonight? And I said, he talked about the fact that Moshe was a good person. It takes me 30 seconds. Level of sophistication and the subtlety and the sweep and the integration. These were manifestos. They were literally masterpieces. That's what made them so compelling. You weren't keyed in. You weren't looking through a keyhole. You're looking through a telescope at the universe. And you're looking at the entire universe through the lens of a particular issue. But everything was broad and incorporating, and it was in wide-angle views. So he reminded us of the Gemara in Sanhedrin. And this one made, as I said before, so compelling. This isn't Rav Lichtenstein speaking, God forbid, based on the influence of Milton and Cardinal Newman. This is Rav Lichtenstein voicing Pasuk in Brachos and the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Chaf Daled, lists a few people that are Pasuk Liedos. And many of them are Pasuk Liedos, not only because they're not trustworthy, unreliable, but because their rank doesn't qualify to be participating in legal litigation. One of them, the Gemara says, source number four, Misachik Bekuvia. Person who idles his time in gambling, card playing, dice rolling, would probably modern equivalent someone who surfs the internet all day. Misachik Bekuvia. So Gemara has two debates, two positions, why Misachik Bekuvia is posuliatus. One position is because he's committed theft, because gambling is equivalent to theft, because you're taking money without license and without authorization. But then the Gemara responds, source number five, after quoting Rami Bar Chamashita, that's the second page, of Sheshes Amar, Kol Kiya Gavne Lama Smachtahi. Gambling does not tantamount to theft, because the people at the table willfully and volitionally relinquish their rights to the money, so you're not stealing money. Elam Lefish Sheena Sukin Bi Yeshuva Shalolam. They are in no way contributing to the public welfare. They're in no way advancing the human condition. They're idling their time needlessly. So a person who doesn't contribute is a subhuman being, is an inferior caliber, and his testimony isn't actionable, isn't acceptable, isn't warranted. That was an epiphany for me. I grew up in a very small Brooklyn room, obviously larger than a room, but it felt like a room. And when I considered my professional goals in life, my ambitions were calculated based on two factors, and two factors only: financial remuneration and time allocation for Torah. In theory, if I could have sold Frankfurters at Madison Square Garden for $1 million, I would have chosen that profession and spent my time learning. And all of a sudden, we all heard that we should choose professions, and not just choose professions, but choose attitudes. It affects which profession you choose, and there's some professions which more directly contribute and advance the human condition, yield human prosperity. And there are others which I'm sure many people at this table are involved in. It's a question of attitude and perspective. If you're a corporate lawyer, you could be a greedy corporate lawyer, isn't it, just to punch the clock and overcharge clients? You see yourself as a cog in the larger machine of human productivity and reliability, and you could either live in New York City and have a productive economy, or live in Venezuela where there's no legal conduct or code and have a dysfunctional world. So everyone at this table is part of a functioning, advanced world of human experience and public welfare, and you're all parts of a larger, and each one plays their function. So it's not just choices, it's also attitudinal. Are you osik bi yeshuva shel olam? Remember towards the end of his life how scathing he was in critiquing the concept of the term of consumer price index, and consumer confidence, and God forbid we should let modern capitalism define ourselves as consumers. It's a culture creep of terms that slowly infiltrate our imagination and dictate our identity. We're consumers. We're producers. We're born to produce. We're born to work. Of course, we have to consume in order to enable production and selflessness. But God forbid we should define ourselves as consumers. So these are the two Gemaras which I've often seen would quote to describe in general, before describing particular elements of a work ethic, to allow us to appreciate why this is important, why it ranks, why even though it may not appear in the Mesillas Yesharim or may not appear in the Chazaras HaTamim, it's part of human identity, and developing a healthy work ethic is necessary for the improvement and the amelioration of the human identity, and thereby yielding a more profound avodas Hashem. He quoted the Medrash, source number 7, about the ennobling effect of a work ethic. There are two narratives to Avraham's pilgrimage to Eretz Canaan. One is predetermined, which HaKadosh Baruch was already determined, Yerushalayim. In a few weeks we'll celebrate the 50th anniversary of our return to Yerushalayim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu selects it. It doesn't divulge it to Avraham, Melaretz HaShe'arecha, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu has predetermined. That's, of course, the dominant narrative. But there's another Medrash in Chazal. Of course, these are all narratives that are not meant to be fact. Are meant to be complementary views of the process, which Avram asserts the choice. Avram renders the decision. He could have chosen Uganda. He could have chosen New York City. And as he travels through the ancient Mediterranean crescent, he visits country after country, culture after culture, and he sees them indulging needlessly, hedonistically, luxuriating. Source number 7, Shaya Avram Halech Baram Narayim Rosam Ochlin Veshosin Upochasin. The word pochasin, orgiastic, frenzied, yechafazon, bechipazon. It's not just how you eat and with that you eat, it's just the style and the manner. Truth is, I think about Revolution a lot when I eat. Because he had a very deliberate style of eating. His hands would move very delicately and he'd cut his meat. It'd be very, it's very refined and very dignified. I also remember my kids make fun of me. I'm telling this to my kids because I attended his house for Shabbos with reverence and fear as if I was entering the Kodesh HaKadosh. But his kids were never given that memo. He's like on the door. So the whole Shabbos, this was when they were younger, my age, and more or less their age, they couldn't stop making fun of him. I mean, it was just having a feeling. I'm sitting there shaking and shuddering, waiting for a sign up. And remember, Tova served fruit cocktail for dessert, and he dared lick the syrup off of the spoon. You would have thought that he committed a federal crime. They were lambasting, Abba! Abba! So every time I'm careful not to lick the syrup. And then Shalosh Shittah's time came, and we had yogurt, so he tore off the top of the yogurt or the ice cream, and he licked the silver foil. My goodness. There's grounds for imprisonment. So he sees them overindulging in food. Amri says, Halavai lo yeh li chelik baretz hazos. This isn't the land that I'm drawn to. Kivan shi'igia l'sulama shel tzor. He reaches more or less Tyre, which is the capital of ancient Phoenicia, and he's getting closer to Eretz Canaan. Ra'osan asukin benichosh b'shas nichosh b'idor b'shas idor. This isn't working, healthy work ethic. I never heard him say this, but I think the Medrash also suggests not just work, but working within a routine. Working in an organized fashion. Sometimes with 18-year-olds, the greater challenge is not to generate intensity in work, but to balance them out. There's a lot of crashes and crests and troughs, and we'll stay up for 3 days and we'll lose minion for 2 days. And it's a question of routine, of living life based on the rhythm of the world, and sleeping at night and working during the day. Sometimes it's hard to capture, but yeah. And I never heard him speak about this issue in general, about this matters, but I think the matters does emphasize B'shas Nichosh, which is to say working, but following a pattern. Amar Avram chooses and asserts, Halavai Yeichelki Baretz Hazos. This is the place I choose to live. Because he senses, even before religion, theology, and even before history, this is even before Jewish history, this is just something very primordial about human identity, about human dignity, and people who work healthy and are committed to the ennobling work ethic. There's a very extensive treatment of work ethic. Again, I don't recall. I remember him quoting that Medrash. I don't recall which part of this Braisa he did or didn't quote, but I added it. It's a very extensive Braisa in Avos Dribnasan. Avos Dribnasan serves as almost like a companion work to Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos is very short and concise and compact, but also becomes cliched and almost transparent because of its cliched. Avos Dribnasan is more of an elaboration of Pirkei Avos. In Pirkei Avos, the Mishnah teaches us that phrase, Ehov Esamalacha. Avos Dribnasan teases out the various dimensions of why and how a person should love work. So I think it's Reb Tarfon, source number two, part days. I'm Reb Tarfon. Afa Kodesh Baruch Hu, Lo Hishresh Shchinasa Al Yisrael, Ach Asu Malacha, Shenemar V'asu V'mikdash, V'shachanti B'salcham, V'tistres V'nasiya. And keep in mind that here we witness work not just as an ennobling aspect of the human condition, but a morally rehabilitative element because of the debacle of the eagle and the descent into the moral confusion and decadence of Kol Ein Zeh Kol Anos, Yara Amki Farua. You almost sense that need to reintegrate the fiber of human moral sensitivity. And the road towards the Mishkan is paved by human industry. You would have thought that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should deliver the Mishkan as a prepared package descending through divine celestial intervention to reshape history, but there's a rallying effect of human conduct to rebuild proper moral sensitivity in the wake of such moral debauchery. So it's not just ennobling, it's also rehabilitative and restorative. It's not just Avram choosing a land because of its moral potential, but a Kodesh Baruch Hu soliciting work and industry. That's really the Binyas HaMishkan, as well as the construction project of the Beis HaMikdash, are two moments in which we see industry at its finest. There are significant differences between the two. The Kodesh Baruch Hu desires human effort to craft the house of the Ribbono Shel Olam, which is itself a theological mystery. Human beings can craft, we can craft skyscrapers that have beautiful views, but how do we craft an edifice that can contain the ineffable and unknowable? A bigger challenge than a skyscraper. So he talked about the ennobling impact of a work ethic. He talked about this once, I don't remember this too often, but I think it's a powerful issue, especially given what is inscribed on his kever. Take a look at source number 10. Excuse me, source number 11. It's a very, very provocative Gemara. Amo Yish Lakish, Maidach Siv, Oved Admaso Yisbal Lechem. It's a pasuk in Mishlei. A person who doesn't just work his land, but is an eved to his land, is a slave to his land, will receive harvest. Seems to be, on a literal level, a pretty cogent pasuk. If you work, you'll reap. Yish Lakish has a different issue in mind. Im Osa Adam Atzmo Ki Eved LeAdama. Your relationship with work should be equivalent to enslavement. You should enslave yourself to your work. Very, very powerful statement. Remember the Gemara says in Bava Metzia that a paul is chozer afilu ben simlachto. If you've hired yourself to be a day laborer, you can withdraw unilaterally. Why? Ki avada hein v'la avadim l'avadim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu despises the notion that man should enslave himself to any item or any concept other than the Baruch Shalom. Avada hein v'la avadim l'avadim. And Rish Lakish suggests and actually endorses enslaving yourself to your work. Quite different from some of the regnant work ethics in corporate America, modern corporations. Im osa adam eved l'adama yisbalechem v'imlav. You're waiting for the punchline, right? I'll take real lechem. Lechem is really Torah. And here we're talking about enslaving yourself to Torah. That's how I, if I were in the room, that's how I would have expected my Heilige, holy Rebbe Rish Lakish to continue. It doesn't mean you should enslave yourself to the ground. It's so pedestrian, it's so secular. The shiur ended. I don't know if the shiur ended, but that drasha ended. I don't remember what Rav Lichtenstein said about this, to be honest. This may be my own perspective. But I think that a work ethic leads to decentralization of self. When you're enslaved and committed to something beyond yourself, that's the road to Avodas Hashem. Once you train yourself in decentralization and stripping yourself of ego and self-interest and selfishness and all the ugly traits that sometimes we fall prey to, we're entrapped by, then the next step is you can decentralize yourself and batel ritzoncha b'nei ritzono. and realize your avodas of Rabbanu Shalom, being Eved Hashem. A couple of weeks ago, I was speaking to the boys in yeshiva, and we were talking about parenting. So let me sum it up for you very simply. Okay, I'll give you four words. If you excel in these four words, you'll be a great father and a great husband. It doesn't take much. Simple Brooklyn logic. I'm not a sophisticated person. I grew up in... Your needs are last. If you train yourself to be the last person in line, and your wife and children, and by extension your community, if your needs are last, you'll be fine. You have a little bit of time on the side. You take care of your own needs. You tend to yourself. A couple of years ago, Rav Lichtenstein was asked what he wants inscribed on his keber. You think something very floral, something very highfalutin, something very aesthetic and almost epic for a man that was so heroic. And he said, I only want two words. And he chose two words very carefully. He said he wants Oved Hashem, not Eved Hashem, because that would be self-promoting and suggest acknowledgement of accomplishment. Eved means you're an Eved Hashem. Oved means you're in the process of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So we're an Oved Hashem. I think that's what made him so compelling to so many of us. And if you want, I think Rabik, who gave it this hesped, I think he really identified the core issue, because it's hard with someone who presented with so many traits. It was hard to find what was the core. What was this? So much. It was so radiant. And it seemed so integrated. It wasn't piecemeal. It wasn't fragmented. And you take an idea that's so integrated, how do you deconstruct it and find its core? And Rabik spoke about him being an Eved Hashem. And think about the way we view religion. I think sometimes we easily divide ourselves into two camps. Most people in this room would probably see us as belonging to the sophisticated camp of religion. We're the thinkers, we're the readers, we're the studiers, we're the organizers. We build large institutions, large structures. And if you take the D train to Brooklyn, back to Borough Park, those are the mikveh dippers, the Tehillim screamers, the Heshmei Rabbah shouters. We're a different DNA. They're each equivalent, but we respect each other's private space. We don't scream when we daven. The mikvah, not that hygienic. Maybe twice a year. We'll keep our distance. And Rav Aaron refused, denied us that acquitting. We couldn't acquit ourselves. Because he was the light in any room he occupied. He was that nobleman. He was the sophisticated. He was the thinker par excellence. He walked into a room, the room froze. Everyone was froze in space. And then to hear him shout his Yehoshua Rabba at the top of his lungs, to hear his Berachas HaTorah pierce Shemayim, seem running to davening, or didn't allow us to bifurcate religion. Because if he was a shouter and a dipper and a till, then what right do I have to acquit myself of those raw expressions of avodas Hashem in the pure sense of submission? Think of it a different way. Think of how we've redefined religion to the modern era successfully. These are the words that we presented religion to this generation, to ourselves. Religion is meaningful and fulfilling. It's redemptive, it's ennobling, it's content, it's values, it's purpose, we've emulsified religion. Religion is also working and serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Eved Lifnei Rabbo and toiling. Ask yourself a different question. When's the last time you actually did something truly difficult as part of your religious experience? Bagels on Sunday morning doesn't count. Shabbos doesn't count anymore because we've reconfigured Shabbos as the great release of modern stress. Shabbos has been recast as the great panacea of an online 24/7 world in which we need to retrieve and spend time with our... I'm not denying that elixir of Shabbos. What about Shabbos Lashem? Remember the last time... When's the last time you had a difficult Shabbos? We probably have some businessmen here at the table, business women at the table, but when's the time your Shabbos stuck in a hotel with no food, stuck in a forest, I imagine in a forest... When's the last time it was really Shabbos Lashem? It's literally desisting, withdrawing from any advance, any opportunity, any continuity, simply to remind yourself as Sheish Yisrael Mas Hashem as the Shemayim Vezaretz Yirel Hashvi Shabbos Ve'inafash. So here's where the work ethic, I think, bled into a different issue, which I think is even more fundamental. Do you see yourself not just as a worker, but as someone that works on behalf of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So he spoke about the nobility of a work ethic, and Avraham's choice of Eretz Yisrael, and the Mishkan as a product of human industry and human productivity, and of course of the decentralization which work can provide. The only time I ever heard Reb Lichtenstein use the following word, such a soft person, such a gentleman. He once told us, he would speak in Yiddish a lot, and I think this was his way, 500 Israelis, maybe three of them knew Yiddish. Then he would have to translate the Hebrew and sometimes even into English. This is his way of bridging us back to Europe. I think he felt that he played that role. It was a bridge back to Rav Huttner and a bridge back to Slabodka. And we'd always have periodically these conversations and symposiums in yeshiva, Gush and Volozhin, what are the differences? And everyone would be scratching their head, what are the differences? What are the similarities? But if you ask me that question, I see them as one line of continuity. The dress may change, and the language, and the president is still the same neshama. It's the same, we're part of the same movement, advancing Torah within the emergence of our great yeshivos, and significant differences. So he once talked about Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and he said, even if he weren't such a big gadol hador, and he went to his Yiddish, Es v'zayin, and your Yiddish, Es v'stein d'sheinste yid in ganzi Yerushalayim, would have been the nicest Jew in all of Yerushalayim, even if he wasn't such a nice person. And when Rav Aaron said that, sometimes in life someone says something and you say, well, you're talking about yourself. This is you. You don't know it. But this is an autobiographical statement. We understood right there this was Rav Aaron, of course, unknowingly, unwittingly describing himself. Just the nicest person you've ever met. Just the kindest, sweetest, soft. I never heard him say the word no. Really. People would come with these crazy, lunatic suggestions for yeshiva. You couldn't say no. People would apply to yeshiva, and there was every reason in the world for them not to be accepted. It's just, maybe we'll see. Maybe we can reconsider. To get the word no out of his mouth was a titanic effort. Whenever the conversation veered towards speaking about people, I could sense the uneasiness. I just didn't want to talk about people. It wasn't even lashon hara, salacious. I didn't feel comfortable talking about people. It was the conversation ended. The conversation ended. The moment it veered towards people. The only time I ever heard him say the word hate, it's unimaginable he'd use the word hate. I don't associate that word with his tongue. But he once said, I hate laziness. I can't tolerate laziness. Indolence. He saw it as a moral flaw, as a fundamental moral deficiency. He quoted the Gemara in Ksuvos. The Gemara in Ksuvos has a list of, please excuse me, it's a bit historically anachronistic, but obviously it doesn't apply in our day, but a woman could be excused from her domestic chores based on the amount of handmaidens that that accompany her into the marriage as part of her dowry. So she has two handmaidens, and she doesn't have to make the bed, but she has to cook. Or she essentially, it's a whole table. So go search for your handmaidens. So the Gemara, the Mishnah in Ksuvos, goes through the reps and the various levels, and source number 6. And finally, well, just for effect, line number 3 from the bottom, Arba, if she has 4 shichas that accompany her into the marriage, she's a princess, Yosheves Bekadarka. She can relax. No work. She's exonerated from all domestic responsibility. She's sitting indulge endlessly in her womanly interests. Reb Eliezer Omer, Afilu Hichnisa La Mea Shvachas. Even if she's accompanied by 100 assistants, Kofel Asos Bitsemer, she still has to weave and knit. Shahabatala Mevi Lidei Zima. The absence of work, idle hands are the tools of the devil, the absence of work. Of course, this is said about one of it. Of course, in our context, it's unisexual, or it's a multi, it's heterogeneous. Afa madrus ishtra milasas melachem shim megamil. Even if a man has forbidden his wife to perform melach, he's taken an edder. We're learning Misach HaShivuos now in yeshiva. Yotzivi tenksuva. Shabbatala mevil lidei shiamum. Boredom, and we... idleness, lack of work, lack of structure, lack of focus. It's morally corrosive. So even if it isn't producing, it's still an experience. Even without any yield, this woman has 100 assistants. What is she doing? What is she involved in? Going back to that mission of Mr. Ibnasan, Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira already addressed this. Source number 2, part Dalid. Adam Shein Lo Malacha Lasos Ma Yaseh. Again, I may have heard this in regard. He has an untillable field. It's scorched. It's already been overplanted. Cotton field down south. Can't be planted. No nutrition in the land. Chareva. Yelech b'yisasekba. Source number Dalad line two. It should still work. Sheshus yamim. Tavor b'yisisacho melechtecha. Lavi. Mishiyesh lo chatzeros osados charevos. Yelech b'yisasekba. You're producing nothing. But you're avoiding moral corruption and moral toxicity. And in an amazing interpretation of a Gemara, I never heard this, it just struck me. It's just, by the way, very few things that Rav Chassin ever said amazed me. Because it was just so panoramic and integrated, it just felt like every time he spoke about something, he was speaking about everything. And it was also so interconnected, isn't that? I never felt myself just taking it. When Rav Amital spoke, I felt myself literally elevated from my imaginative space. I thought my head was on a swivel. Couldn't imagine what was coming out of his mouth the next minute. And it changed my life. It changed my identity. It was a different person 3 seconds after he said it than beforehand. It wasn't that feel with Rav Lichtenstein. And I take that because it was just, he built us from bottom up. And it was just all integrated, all polluted. The sweep was so large. And it was so compelling because it was so panoramic, because you felt like this was everything. This was someone speaking with a voice of an entire sweep. And I was teaching the girls a few weeks ago a very famous essay of Rav Lichtenstein about the clash between human morality and divine code. Who hasn't spoken about it? From Kierkegaard. And Rav Amital, famous statement, Rav Amital, Veretz Yisrael L'Bnei Adam. And I taught the girls Rav Lichtenstein's article in By His Light. He maybe dedicated 4 lines to actually addressing the issue. But he spent 40 pages. What's morality? What's kindness? What's goodness? What's from God? By the time you got to the punchline, it was irrelevant because he had already taken you on a tour of everything you possibly need to know. And that particular question, okay, so you'll deal with it. The clash between a Kodesh Baruch Hu's will and human. Okay, we'll deal with it when it comes time. When you're asked to eliminate a Moloch, you find the terrorists when you go out to her. But wasn't that issue with something so much larger and so much more pervasive? But this is to me very revelatory. Source number 10, very famous Gemara, Amar Rish Lakish, going back to Rish Lakish. Nachri Shashavas, Chayiv Misa. We all know this is a special treaty between ourselves and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Any Gentile who dares infiltrate that personal day of intimacy, in Baruch Hashem, history has protected Shabbos for the Jews, the Muslims chose Friday, the Christians show Sunday, this is our day. Prisi Benirvim Ben Yisrael Osiliyom. Special divine providence to protect Shabbos. We've read this Gemara, we've seen this Gemara, we've joked about this Gemara. But then the Gemara concludes. Amar Avina, that we haven't seen too often. I feel a sheni b'Shabbos. Every Christian is chayv misa. Not really, because it only pertains to someone that keeps Shabbos in the halachic manner. But if a culture were to choose any other day during the week and adhere to Shabbos in the full halachic manner, they'd also be chayv misa. Just feels haitochin. Remember Rav Lichtenstein with the haitochin, or the deep Ashkenazic guttural haitochin. Is it possible? Why? How can it make sense of Ravina? It chose Tuesday. Why should they be chayv misa? Rav Aaron explained that any human being who volitionally and institutionally eliminates a day of work is chayav misa, unless there's a divine instruction sanctioning it. The very choice to stop and halt work, again, is chayav misa, is such a gross crime that it could be categorized as a federal offense deserving of capital punishment. Of course, it wouldn't enforce it. So if a Jew halts work on Shabbos, that's because the Kodesh Baruch Hu instructed it, because it's a springboard to higher religious consciousness and more metaphysical. But the unilateral decision to withdraw from work is so degrading and erosive of human identity that it's sanctionable as Misa. Because of its moral dangers. Because of the moral perils. It's not just the invasion of Shabbos that entails the crime. It's the decision to withdraw from work without divine framework or divine purpose or higher agenda. Amazing, amazing. I thought, I never would have thought of that. My processing of the Gemara would have been Ravina just somehow extending Rish Lakish. Going to Rish Lakish, if a guy infiltrates Shabbos, going to Ravina, if he applies Shabbos to Monday, it's getting too close to Shabbos. It's a Gzera. If they keep Monday, they'll keep Shabbos. No. For Ravina, it was just simply the unilateral decision to withdraw from work without some divine purpose or divine agenda. That's why Rav Lichtenstein loves sports. I remember Tova pleading with me at the Shiva. Please don't let them whitewash my husband's memory and write some gadol book which omits the fact that he loves sports. Please. It's my job. I'm just a little... Please. Because it combined three values that he so deeply regarded. Work ethic. Working hard. Teamwork. Selflessness. Love, the sense of being selfless. And time management, which is not really the topic of today's shiur, but he wants time management. He told us that, and please don't try this at home, that he never in his life took an afternoon nap. His entire life. I need to go to sleep right now at this table. One of the many areas of my life. All the areas I don't achieve. One of the areas I don't even aspire to. Never took a nap in the afternoon. Whatever Koach Hashem gave you for the day, you utilize it to waste those resources, to just dissipate. It's a real motivator. I mean, we're all tired, obviously. I feel sometimes embarrassed to be tired. Because Rav Lichtenstein never caved to his fatigue. He never let us believe it. He would get off of that plane, and we'll remember, get off of that plane, 12-hour, he never traveled business class. You probably remember all the attempts to get into travel business class because it was immoral. Remember the first time I went for the yeshiva to interview students in 1995, I came back with my receipts for my reimbursement. I went to Yediyah. What does he know about America? I said, here's my receipt. He says, what's this? I said, it's for the cab from the airport to where I was staying. He says, why do you need to take a cab? I said, why don't you take a cab? Did I miss something? He says, Rav Lichtenstein has been traveling for 20 years, and he takes the subway from the airport to wherever he was staying in Queens. He got with his bags. And I could spend 3 hours telling you stories that are derivatives of that story about not wasting other people's money and not being served. But the one time, actually, when he was later in his life, and he was a little bit, obviously, convalescent, so we finally convinced him, evidently, I wasn't on the plane, I said I wasn't in business office, but I wasn't on the plane, he went to every single stewardess and apologized. They forced me to do it. You always forced me to do it. I really want to travel business class. It was morally embarrassing for him to be in business class. So he apologized if he had offended people by taking his business class seat.
It was after the hip surgery.
But even after the surgery, it took us a while. I remember I was once on a flight, and I had row 22 or something closer to the front, and he was in the back with SD, and there was maybe 200 kids from Birthright screaming, shouting, tossing balls across the aisle. I asked Rebecca, I said, Rebbe, please switch with me. I'll give you my seat. I'll sit in the back. I'll sit in the zoo. You sit in front. As if that was the single greatest chilul Hashem that could be perpetrated, that he would take my seat. The world would end. So then I spent 20 minutes convincing the stewardess that we had greatness on the plane. Could she find him a seat? And she did. So she found him an empty seat. No one was occupying it. He refused to take it. I spent my whole trip looking back at him and Esty sitting like two little sheep. And a circus around them screaming. And, I mean, wonderful kids. Nothing wrong with it. They weren't violating any crimes or offenses. But a sense of time management, to utilize time. I remember him lamenting. We just had this conversation at my Shabbos table about talking about SD. You have a panel conversation over Shabbos. We had our alumni reunion from 1983 and 1984. So she talked about the role of women in modern Orthodoxy. And Rav Lichtenstein used to lament the fact that in the 80s, boys were trained educationally to manage their time and maximize their time and utilize every minute. And somehow he felt that in women's education, that ethos hadn't been conveyed. It was very laissez-faire and relaxed and leisurely study, take a course. I hope that's changed. I'm not as involved in female education, but sense of time utilization and time management. And on that note, we have to manage our time. Let me just conclude with the final. We talked about the nobility, the moral dangers, the decentralization. Finally, of course, when a person works, it's not only improving his moral character or avoiding the dangers of idleness or decentralizing ego, there's a sense you're partnering with a Kodesh Baruch Hu, that you're ascending beyond mortality, that you're reaching beyond your grasp, that Rav Lichtenstein used to say so lovingly. What is man if his dreams don't exceed his grasp? As grounded as we are by gravity and our humanity, when we work and contribute and produce, we're perfecting a world alongside of the Ribbono Shel Olam. We become partners. This, of course, is a famous conversation which took place between Rabbi Akiva and the Roman general philosopher Plinius Rufus. Source number, I think it's on the first page. Oh, perfect timing, Parshas Tazria. It's always the skula if you happen to serendipitously hit a pasuk from the Parsha. So it's a Kodesh Baruch Hu and Shemayim is happy. Even though it was in Parshas Tazria, it's a medrash. Yishaki Tazria, the eldest Zachar. Benchron Asimim, famous question. The Greeks, by extension, the Romans, were horrified by genital mutilation, defacing the beauty of the human body. So he challenged Rabbi Akiva, the famous challenge. He didn't say these words, but Memanoshech, he asked Rabbi Akiva. If circumcised males represent the ideal state of the human body, why didn't HaKadosh Baruch Hu create human beings circumcised? If Hashem created human beings uncircumcised, then evidently it's a vandalism. Not the first time, not the last time. So what would be key to answer? Source number 3. He said, bring me some food. They brought some bread, some cookies. HaKadosh Baruch Hu create the bread, the cookies. Of course not. Yet we recite the Bracha Motzi Lechem in Arts as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu created bread, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu intentionally allowed this world to remain imperfect. Shabbos, they resisted or withdrew unnaturally, it's called Tzimtzum, should have necessarily created infinitely, because he is infinite, because he wanted to allocate room for human industry and human complex. The great secret of human identities is partnership with their Ribbono Shel Olam. It's bilateral at an individual level, and as we'll see next week, it's bilateral at a historical level. We feel the great song of Shir HaShir, we're partners with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in shaping history and in battling through history. That's the love we'll all feel next week when we mourn our fallen and we celebrate our triumphs. Our fun. Once again, finally, we're partners in history rather than historically disempowered. When we work, probably the closest we come to partnering with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We search for him morally. We try to be like him. Maharachu, Mafatarachu, Mahochanan. Try to be as moral as we can. But we sense an unbridgeable abyss between our morality and his morality. Who here can even arrogate to themselves the dream of being as moral as the Ribbono Shel Olam Chanan v'Rachum, Rafei Chovatzer Mafli Lasas? We try. We use that as the touchstone for our own goals. But when we work, we're not just patterning ourselves after the Ribbono Shel Olam, as the Medrash says. Source number 8. Can a person really walk in the wake of Hashem? Can a person truly become like a Kodesh Baruch Hu? This is a question posed by Chazal often. Sometimes the answer is moral discovery, Maharachu Mafatarachu, Gemara in Sota, the Gemara in Shabbos. Other times it's affiliating with Talmidei Chachamim, Habdeik Talmidei Chachamim. But in this instance, Rabbi Yehuda Bar Simon told us, Ela mitchilas b'riyaso shel olam, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu first created the world, lo nisasik HaKadosh Baruch Hu ela b'mata tchila. What's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's first prerogative? Vayim HaShem Elokim, Gan Eden. Creates Gan Eden. Af atem, line number 2 from the bottom, source 8, Kshatem nichnasim la'aretz. This is a very important statement about Zionism. It's not really our topic today. When you enter the land, you may not learn Torah first. Lo tisasku ela b'mata tchila. First work and develop and produce. And Namar Kitavar Laritz of Zeschem, there Altimar also, there's a pasuk in Kedoshim about Orlam, working and planting. To be like a Kodesh Baruch Hu, to partner with a Kodesh Baruch Hu, this is part of our bris. Shabbos is a bris. The only time I would say that we're closer to a Kodesh Baruch Hu than when we're collaborating on work is when we're withdrawing from work. Because it reminds us that as much as we can be similar to him in collaboration, there's no way to replicate his activity. And the only way we replicate is by withdrawing, reminding ourselves that the room for human industry was carved out by Hashem by allocating Shabbos and halting his own productivity, passing the baton to human beings. That's why the Gemara says in Shabbos, Kolomer Vayechulu Shemayim Varetz Nasa Shutef LaKadosh Baruch Hu B'Briyas Olam. Very famous Gemara of Soloveitchik talked about that. What's a magical potion, a magical statement? You say Vayechulu, you're a partner to Hashem. You say Vayechulu, you realize this building, our work, our productivity, our accomplishments, our triumphs, the thing we've built, that space, not just the resources to contribute, but the space to build, it's been provided by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, carving it out unnaturally. But this is second place. This is almost as close. Or, and we'll conclude with this statement, going back to the famous series of statements in Avos L'Nasam. Ketzad, this is a primary statement, source 2, part Aleph, Melameh she'adam oeve semelacha, ve'al yeh adam stoneh semelacha, shekeshem shahatara nitna bebris, just as Tara was given as part of a bris, bilateralism, Tara she'bechsav, Tara she'balpeh, Nasan lanu Tara semes, Tara she'bechsav, v'chaya olam nata besochinu, Tara she'balpeh, shenemar kach hamelacha nitna bebris. Shenemar Sheshes Yamin Ta'avov. Almost every time or several times in the Torah introduces Shabbos, it doesn't just instruct us to withdraw on Shabbos. It instructs us to work. Sheshes Yamin Ta'avov. Shesem Yaseh Malachtecha. V'yom HaShvei Tishbaz. V'yom HaShvei Shabbos Hashem Elokecha. So I hope this shiur conveyed beyond just the content, conveyed how far-reaching and innovating this moral pursuit was, this moral journey. How it infiltrated aspects of human identity that somehow we don't immediately associate with our day-to-day religious pursuit. Second of all, how panoramic the discussion was. It was never linear. It was always lateral. It incorporated. And finally, how we were surprised to see that these calls to moral improvement, which we sensed innately, nothing here I've said today is a surprise, is a shocker. Nothing here we want to subscribe to these values, but they're also part of our Masara, if we're just sufficiently attentive to the way Chazal speak and the way the Pesukim are orchestrated. So, Amir Hashem, our hope is that we'll spend many, many, many years living our lives in the shadow of his accomplishments and being spurred, motivated by his accomplishments and who he was as a person. And to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the great privilege we all had, some of us more direct, some of the others, some of us qualify as Talmidim, others are Talmidi Talmidehem. It's really the sign of a gadol. If you have some talmidim in this room of mine, I hope I've impacted your lives. I will continue to impact your lives, the lives of your families and children. I don't imagine your grandchildren will be affected by my life. I have talmidim. A gadol has talmidim. A gadol's impact trickles and cascades. So even those who didn't learn in the yeshiva, you can get to yourself talmidim. Everyone have a great day with all of you.
Rabbi Harry, and thank you for the special shiur in memory of Aaron. I just wanted to mention also Rabbi Karagin and Rabbi Chavis will be speaking tonight in Bergenfield at Beth Abraham at 8:30. I'm just going to ask for those that had bread, will bench, especially after this year. I want to make sure everybody gets to work and like not be in trouble. So, and then after benching, we'll do a quick mincha if possible, and then we'll have to leave the room by 2.
Sure.
So, Rabbi Schrader, can you lead us in benching?
Yeah. She works at home. She's doing a bunch of different things.
Does someone have a chiyuv?
We just actually auditioned people for someone.
Does somebody has a chiyuv? Okay, I'm just going to wait a minute.
Thank you. Thank you.